Have you given any thought to contributing to The Melt? It's easy to do. Just click the Patreon link in the episode notes, and for as little as $3 a month, you can get access to bonus episodes, early access to regular episodes, and you can also participate in monthly Zoom meetups. It helps to keep the magic happening here at The Melt. So I encourage you to karmically entangle yourself with The Melt today by subscribing monthly for less than the price of a container of goatee wax, or a prosthetic pinky, or a half stick of DMT butter, or an inflatable casket, or the shrunken head of an Atlantean supermodel, or a woolly mammoth's merkin, or a crystalline replica of Baba Yaga's hut, or a capsule of Sasquatch dander.
This is Hunter Muse.
And this is Chris Snipes. And you are listening
to The Melt.
Rose 777 has been a huge help to me and The Melt in regards to helping set me in the direction of who to talk to about natural law and sovereignty, topics which I began to cultivate a deeper interest in after listening to many back episodes of Crow 777 Radio and Mark Passio lectures. She's been great about hooking me up with folks that I'd like to have on The Melt about a variety of things and has always been super helpful. When I was looking more into the natural law world, she offered to come on and talk about her personal experiences with it, and that's what she's here today to do. I start off the conversation by asking Rose how she came to be interested in the types of topics that she covers in her own work and in the work she does with Crow 777.
So I would say that just like many other people, I really started to question things a couple years after 9/11. During 9/11, though, just to give you an idea of where I was at, is I was, you know, a registered libertarian, and I thought that George Bush was the man and that we just needed to get those weapons of mass destruction and that the Middle East was so screwed up that maybe we just needed to drop a nuclear bomb and wipe the Petri dish clean, which is an idea that I actually got from a history teacher. I mean, I feel that that idea was, I was influenced by that history teacher at Santa Barbara City College at the time. I don't think that I would have independently thought of nuking an entire region of the realm. But what was taught to me was that that conflict was not repairable. You know, there's nothing that can be done and they're always going to be fighting. And that there was no way that it could be solved. That was the narrative that I was sold in college. But then slowly, after I left the corporate world, I was the global training manager for customer support and tech support at Citrix Online, which has since been bought out by LogMeIn. And it was very easy for me to climb the corporate ladder. I don't know if it was the wheelchair card or the fact that I didn't respond negatively in meetings where men were making jokes about women or, you know, things like that. But I reached a certain point where it just wasn't fulfilling for me. And I thought that maybe I should go back to school to become an elementary school teacher. And that is when I learned about all of the paperwork and the BS that goes along with it, and learning about the kinds of things that elementary school teachers have to deal with. And it just wasn't going to be a good fit for me. And also, I started calling poppycock on a lot of the things that I was being told when I was going to school. Like, for example, in my early childhood education classes, they mentioned epigenetics. And in our, you know, circles these days, we do talk about the importance of epigenetics and how powerful it is and how it could unlock a lot of secrets to our healing. But according to those college classes, epigenetics is simply nothing but methyl molecules that are on the outside of the DNA strand that act as on and off switches for genes. So let's say I have the quote unquote cancer gene. It's really the methyl molecules that are going to dictate whether that is going to be expressed. And I'm not saying this is how I believe it works. This is just what they taught me. But then in 2013, I discovered the work of Mark Passio. And I learned about the principles of anarchy, natural law, and epigenetics. I started looking into the work of Bruce Lipton and Joe Dispenza. And I realized...
Love him.
I'm so glad. I figured you knew who he was. And I I realized that what academia has left out, especially in science, but in everywhere, is consciousness, the metaphysical, the quote unquote supernatural, which doesn't mean magic. It just means greater than natural, like something that we don't understand because we can't see it. So once I realized that, I went to, and this is where my story really begins in my awakening. In 2016, I went to Langhorne, Pennsylvania to the Free Your Mind Conference because I wanted to see Mark Passio. He had been such a fantastic influence on me and changed my perspective about natural law. And I felt like I finally had a direction. I didn't know where I was going to end up or how I was going to get there, but I just knew I had to go to this conference and meet other people that felt the same way I did. And I didn't even know who Freeman Fly was. I remember I was smoking a cigarette with him. I was smoking at the time. I was smoking a cigarette with Freeman Fly in, outside of the building, and I introduced myself as Rose. And I didn't understand why he didn't introduce himself to me, you know? And then we walk in together, or I roll next to him, and I watch him go up on the stage, and I was like, oh, that's Freeman Fly. He just assumed I knew who he was. And I also got to meet people like Larkin Rose, Mark Devlin, Jim Mars, rest in peace, Jim Fetzer. It was a fantastic day. And guess who else was there? Jason Lindgren.
So
he saw me rolling around, zipping around. And the funny thing is that when I saw him, based on what he was wearing and the expression on his face, I just kind of felt like he probably was like had a thick German accent. And you know what Jason Lindgren sounds like.
Yes. And I know what he looks like, too. I've seen pictures, so I could totally see that.
Yeah, right? Yeah. So I had no idea that he wasn't even living in Pennsylvania. Half of my family is in the Philadelphia area. But when I went back to California and I found out that he was in Louisiana, I was like, oh, no, that's too humid. Like, that's never going to work out, you know? But then I had that... that life turning upside down moment where I thought that I had arrived, that I had succeeded. You know, I had my own condo in Santa Barbara. I had not one, but two wheelchair ramp vans. Mm-hmm. And wow. I thought I live in the best town of the best state of the best country in the world. And then all of a sudden everything changed. And to make a really long story short, I was basically a homeless person in a wheelchair, and in order to get access to a wheelchair-accessible bathroom, I ended up marrying a brain-damaged, stolen valor, fake Vietnam lieutenant with brain damage in a wheelchair that I met when I was finishing a round of antibiotics in a nursing home in Van Nuys. And so all of these things were going down. I'm trying to figure out where my direction was. I didn't know what my future was going to hold. I didn't know if I was ever going to speak to my family again. And it was all because of two felony counts for a crime that I didn't commit that happened while I was in the hospital with a broken leg. It's interesting because even though it's so blatantly obvious that I was innocent, when there's like an article in the paper and you're just perceived as a social miscreant or someone that is, you know, breaking the law, it just changes everyone's perception of you. It's almost like, remember in The Big Lebowski when that cop was like, get out of my beach community?
Yeah, yeah.
That's how I felt. I was like, I didn't do anything, but there's this perception going on. And, you know, so I ended up on a leap of faith moving in with Jason Lindgren on September 19th of 2017. And I had no idea who Crow was. He had sent me a couple of like lunar wave clips and I was looking on my phone and I didn't know what I was supposed to be seeing. So like, I thought maybe it was a UFO flying across. I didn't realize it was that, you know, digital looking
the ripple
going down.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
But then the first time, so Jason comes to pick me up from the airport and I guess he had told Crow that morning because they used to only record on Wednesdays since Jason was working at Guitar Center full time. Mm-hmm. And so he had told, I took a red eye and he had told Crow, I just have to go pick someone up from the airport and then I'll be right back and we'll record. And Crow said, do you have a girlfriend? And so he just picked on that immediately. So Jason comes to pick me up. It was really that much of a leap of faith. I'm so grateful that it worked out. And we went back and I heard him record that show, which I believe was episode 73, which was the weather modification. The first episode that I helped do research for was episode 74 on RH negative. And then another episode that really helped me to quit smoking cigarettes was the research for Edward Bernays episode 78. Remember the Torches of Freedom? I was like, oh man, I got socially engineered into smoking. I gotta quit. So, so ever since then, I've kind of finagled my way into kind of becoming the manager, producer, everything other than on the mic of Crow 777 Radio in order for them to continue doing what they do. They just don't have time to do anything but be on the mic and edit. Jason editing.
That's a fantastic tale. I love it. And so you guys, wow. Obviously you wrote, you communicated before you took the leap.
Yes, because I was communicating with him about the crazy man that I married for the wheelchair accessible bathroom. And what happened was, is this man, he's dead now, by the way, unfortunately. Well, I'm sad that he has got that. Whatever happened to him to make him the human being he was, I will never know. I guess in my mind, I had thought this person has never felt love before. And maybe if someone was just nice to him, he would change. So I had that lesson. yes. And obviously, it wasn't like supposed to be like a long term romantic. He's, you know, at the time I was like 30, he was like 63. It was mostly like trying to figure out caregiving and the wheelchair access. And I suppose we didn't really need to get married, but he was kind of crazy and it just happened. It just kind of, I think I just treated it like a joke while it was happening. But then when he got physically abusive, what happened was, and I hope that this isn't like too awkward to mention, I always deal with things like with a smile on my face and like comedy. But if you can imagine like a game of Tetris, it was like we were playing Tetris with our wheelchairs with me trying to escape. And remember, he was lying about being in Vietnam, but he was accusing me of being some Cambodian woman that cursed him in Vietnam. And at the time, of course, I didn't realize that he had been lying. I had to do the math later on to figure out it was impossible that he ever could have been in Vietnam. He probably got into a car accident in his 20s and was in the hospital with a bunch of vets. And maybe he's brain damaged. Sure. Maybe he really believed that he went there. But he was not strong. He was like a stick figure. He had no strength whatsoever. I am way stronger than him. But when he hit me and his nail kind of like scratched my forehead a little bit, I was like, well, you just divorced me. I'm not going to stay in a situation where someone's physically abusive. I just got my ticket out. And he tried to swing again. And so I grabbed his shoulder and I twisted it just enough. And I looked into his eyes and I said, DJ, I don't want to hurt you. And then I pushed back in my wheelchair, grabbed his painkillers, and I poured the bottle of painkillers in front of his wheelchair, making a barrier. So that if he wanted to come towards me, he would have to roll over his pills. So right. That's how I got out, and I was hyperventilating and having a panic attack. And then I get this Facebook message from Jason out of nowhere saying, Rose, I haven't heard from you in a while, and I'm feeling very concerned about you. My phone then died, and I had nothing but a Surface Pro. And I remember I went into a Denny's, and I felt so bad for being in the Denny's and, like, not ordering enough food to utilize their Wi-Fi and air conditioning. Isn't that weird? Like, right now I could go into Denny's and I won't feel guilty about spending 2 hours there if I feel like it. But just being in that vulnerable situation where I felt like this homeless loser in a crisis, sweating and hyperventilating and not really buying any food, I was just telling Jason, I'm like, can you please contact this person and that person? And Jason is the one that coordinated with someone to pick me up, get me to a hotel so I could buy my ticket and jump on the plane with the clothes on my back.
So how did you lose your two vans and your Santa Barbara situation? Like, what was that transition?
Okay, so I'm so blessed and lucky that after I was paralyzed, I was paralyzed in 2005 due to a stroke in my spinal cord, which is an unknown reason. We could spend a whole show talking about how it could have happened, like what it could possibly be. But my parents had enough money to buy a condo for me and have it wheelchair accessible. And I was not paying rent for that. So it was not my home. So I will go into more detail about that because I guess you're very curious about how I could go to being homeless. But I had gone to one of these music festivals called Lucidity, if anyone out there has ever heard of it. It's in the mountains of behind Santa Barbara. And, you know, I met people that were kind of like new age hippie people. Mm-hmm. And there was a couple and the boyfriend was interested in manufacturing DMT to try and help people, quote unquote, you know. And at the time I'm like, oh, that's nice. Never done DMT. Don't know how to make it. Never seen it. Don't know anything about it. And I was kind of letting them crash. They weren't sleeping in my house. They were sleeping in their car. But then they'd come in and take a shower and we'd all, you know, talk about philosophy and, you know, anarchy on my patio, you know, stuff like that. And then all of a sudden I wake up in the hospital with a broken femur. And I didn't know that 5 days had gone by. I didn't realize it because I was drugged up. But I suppose what happened was he assaulted me so that he could use my condo to manufacture. And I made this joke to the judge. I'm like, they didn't even do it right. Shouldn't I be charged with attempted manufacturing of DMT while having a broken leg in the hospital? And by the way, the courts do not appreciate humor. It doesn't work. Don't ever smile in a courthouse. These are all the things, these experiences I had with the courthouse. And, you know, even seeing the girlfriend who I don't fault for anything, really, I feel like she was kind of influenced by this man. When I saw her, I tried to, as a defendant, she was a defendant and I wasn't like arrested or anything. I wished I had been arrested because then I would have gotten 3 square meals and the human rights wheelchair accessible bathroom, right? So I'm like having to show up at 8 a.m. to a courthouse and I'm looking at them bring her in and I'm smiling at her. And just when she turned her head and smiled back at me, this other female cop grabbed her chin and returned her head away from me in this really sadistic manner. And that's when I realized, okay, it's cool that I understand the principles of anarchy and natural law, but I don't know anything about how this court system works and how the heck these people have the right to get away with this kind of behavior towards other human beings.
Yeah.
And so that's how, so my parents were like, drugs? No, you can't go back. You know, you can't live there. We'll send you to like a special home for disabled people or something for a while until you can get back on your feet. And I was like, I'm 30 years old. I could take care of myself. And so when I got out of rehab for my leg, after I got transferred to physical rehab for my femur after the hospital, I had a plan to move in with one of my best friends from high school. But because of the injury, I couldn't use this cute little wheelchair that I am sitting in right now. I had to have a Lieutenant Dan wheelchair where my leg is always elevated. So I get to Anto's house thinking, I got a plan. I'm going to be fine. And I realized that my turning radius could not allow me to use her bathroom independently. And believe me, she and her boyfriend would have been fine with me staying there. But this is just an example of how hard it is to ask for help and to feel like a burden. Sure. I remember hearing on a movie like a house guest is like a fish. It only lasts for 2 days and then it becomes a bad thing. Right. So I kept thinking about that. And as soon as I realized I wasn't going to be able to use the bathroom there independently, I left. And I was just I put my cats in I spent like $800 on putting my cats into a place, and I was staying, you know, the Motel 6 in Santa Barbara on Cabrillo was $300 a night at the time. And I was just putting things on my credit card until my parents sent a lawyer to visit me at a coffee shop. And he said, you need me. You need me or you can go to jail for a very long time. This is about a 7-year sentence. And I was so scared, and I thought, okay, I guess I can take a cash advance out on my credit card for $7,000, and that's all I have. And he said, okay, that will take you to trial. I was like, okay, but then what happens if we go to trial? And he said, well, we'll cross that bridge when we get there. So I decided to write – this was my idea. I don't even know how I thought of this looking back, but I wrote a contract – basically saying that, you know, if I provide you with this $7,000, do you agree to these certain things? But I didn't know anything at the time, but at least my mind was on the right track. Like, I was trying to hold the lawyer accountable to something, but I just didn't have any knowledge. So he didn't do anything. In fact, I think the reason the charges were lowered to a misdemeanor with unsupervised probation was because I brought DJ with me. I dragged him up on an Amtrak with me to an appearance, and he was so crazy and miserable and screaming about Vietnam and calling me his fiance that I think that they had a little meeting and they're like, this girl's had enough punishment. If she's truly going to marry that insane guy, that's all the punishment she needs.
And your parents helped you get a lawyer for the two felony charges that you had.
They found him and sent him to me to tell me that I needed him, but I paid for it. I took a cash advance out on a credit card.
Right.
Making me so broke that I couldn't get a hotel room anymore.
But they basically were trying to help you kind of extricate yourself from a situation that you found yourself in. So it wasn't like they were kind of leaving you high and dry. They were trying to help you in whatever way they felt they could.
They were doing what they thought was best for me at the time, which was to say, you can't live in your condo anymore. I thought I had the right to be there because I'd been there for 10 years or something. Didn't have any contract with them, but really it was their condo. You know, something occurred in that condo that was illegal, and they had every right to be upset. And maybe I don't know where I would be today if I did listen to them and follow their advice and go into some group home and stay in Santa Barbara. But I sure am glad I wasn't in California since 2020, right? It is seemingly a blessing in disguise that I got the heck out of there, because as of now, I don't relate in any way, shape, or form to anyone that I used to know in California.
It's interesting, too, because they could have been held liable for what was happening since it was their name on the mortgage of that condo. Mm-hmm. They could have been held liable for anything that was going on in that condo, even if they weren't there. So
that's why they had every right to be upset. That's why they had every right.
Absolutely. It seems like by design, they did the best thing for you, which was to get you the fuck out of there.
Well, it's like, it's so interesting the way things panned out, because I could not be more grateful for where I'm at today. And I don't know what kind of other horrible situation could have happened for me to leave California. Because at the time, I thought that was the best place in the world. And I almost felt like my life was over, that I was leaving. And now I just could not be happier. And
it's amazing.
I couldn't be more proud of what I'm doing with my life, and that I feel like there is meaning, and that everything, I couldn't ask for a better outcome than what happened.
And so much chaos created order for you. That's what's so fascinating, is that you had to go through this extremely chaotic period with extremely chaotic people, which in some ways seem like it was the right place to be, but you were in the exact opposite of that. You were in the wrong place to be in the long term.
Yes.
I love it. That's fantastic.
Well, welcome to where you're supposed to be.
Thank you so much.
Via the long route.
Yeah.
So had Crow, by the time you crossed paths with Jason and Crow and their show, had he already had Mark Passio on? Did you guys already have that in common?
Okay, so check it out. As soon as I felt like Crow knew me well enough for me to make any kind of suggestion whatsoever, because as far as he was concerned, I was just some random girlfriend of Jason. He didn't know what kind of person I was, although Jason did tell him that I was genetically an Ashkenazi Jew, which is true. And then Crow said, oh, that must mean she's really smart. And I was like, that's racist. And but he's like, no, it's statistically, every Ashkenazi I've ever met has been really smart. And I was like, well, that's really weird that he's saying that. I'm really uncomfortable with that. You know what I mean? Like, it's like I was coming from a certain kind of cognitive bias where I couldn't believe that someone was telling me that I must be smart just because of my genetics. And then I was talking to him about how I knew Sandy Hook was a complete fraud, because there was no wheelchair accessible ramps into the bungalows. So it's just impossible that elementary school was in operation. I know that it's just not possible. So then I suggested Mark Passio in an email, and I put maybe 10 links, and that was probably way overloading him, to talk about it. And he went to whatonearthishappening.com. And what just come out was Mark Passio's presentation, Fake Ass Christians. And just because of the negative vibe of the name of that presentation, I think Crow just didn't look any longer and was just like, I'm not really vibing with this. So that was around episode 80-ish when I brought up Mark Passio, but I didn't finally get him on the show until episode 250 and 271.
Wow.
And I haven't heard either of those episodes. How did they mesh? How did Mark's vibe? Mark's got a very definite, like, kind of a square jaw vibe going on. It seems belittling sometimes if you're not used to it. So you really, as I alluded to in an email to you, it's about the message. It's not about the messenger. He has his own kind of charisma, and it's not going to be for everybody.
Yeah, it was for me, though. I needed to hear that information from an angry South Philly accent. That's what it worked for me. And that's why he always used to say, he's like, you know, this is not, there's nothing new under the sun. He didn't make up this information. He doesn't own it. He just made a tapestry of the information that he aggregated. And anybody who goes and listens to, I would recommend listening to his podcast up until maybe like the 200s before he got really upset. And you add your own aesthetic to it. So you could also look up my friend Jana, who never promotes herself and she only works off donations. And her website is Jana, JanaESP.com. And she covers natural law in her own way, her own aesthetic, and it's absolutely beautiful. So if you have looked into Mark Passio's work and it's a little too aggressive for you, then she is an alternative that you could go to hear things in a more beautiful way, you know, beautiful artwork and music along with it. And I've tried to get her even just to come on a simple live stream, and she just doesn't do it. She doesn't care about fame or making money. She just produces this incredible material and puts it on her website, and that's it. I think she really is walking the walk. Me, I'm a slave to my subscribership. If someone forgets their password and doesn't know how to reset it, you know, I have to be there. But, you know, Jana is a slave to nobody. She doesn't have to worry about a membership, but she is able to support herself off of just sticking to her principles and putting out information, and she is supported. Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
Love fantastic. It.
Yeah.
So the kind of natural law that Mark Passio talks about is a lot different than the kind of natural law that, say, Brandon Sibley talks about. Both of that is covered on Crow's show. What are the difference between those two types of natural law? How did Brandon help you, I think not too long ago, when you had to go into the hospital in Louisiana?
Okay. Really quick, I'm going to answer your question about how the episodes went. The 250 was on the Trivium and the Quadrivium. That's how I sold it to Grow. I'm like, look, in this day and age, people are pulling their kids out of school. We need our audience to be familiar. No better person to do it than to cover it than than Mark Passio. And then 271 was about anarchy and Satanism. So anyway, they meshed well together. I thought they vibed really well. Now, the difference between Mark Passio and Brandon is totally all for utilizing the system that's in place and understanding how the court works. Just like with Dr. Graves' course, howtowinincourt.com, you are accepting the fact that there is a system, and because we are in the right and standing for truth, we learn and utilize those processes to protect ourselves. Now, I can't speak for Mark Passio, but if I can take myself back to 2017 and 2018 and pretend that I'm hearing about all these people that are using the courts in order to protect themselves, I'd be like, but the government's corrupt. They don't even follow their own rules. How do you think that you can make a change by being a Trojan horse in government? Government is slavery, you know, so maybe I was a little bit dramatic in the differences there, but that's how I see it, is that Brandon is able to utilize, he's okay with utilizing the system, whereas I would imagine that Mark Passio is like, he's not going to step foot in a court, you know, they'd have to arrest him and drag him there, you know what I mean? And he has been arrested. So I think that in terms of do no harm, take no shit, they agree. They agree on the moral principles. But the thing is that Mark Passio doesn't believe in the Constitution as a piece of paper that men created. Mark Passio would say that the Constitution is codified by the laws of the universe. Natural law, according to him, are the laws of the universe that govern the consequences of human behavior. And I would say that Brandon agrees with that 100% as well. It's just how we deal with it in the world. Like, there are other people I know who feel so good about the fact that they've changed their status to American national by changing their paperwork and denying the birth certificate and getting different stars put on their passport. I think that's totally cool. If you have a spiritual satisfaction from that and it helps you in your conviction in being who you are during the psychological battle that you may have to engage in when dealing with other human beings, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Sure. I also think it depends on where you are in the world and where you are internally, where you are inside of your own universe, because I think if you go out and seek conflict, you're going to find it. There's plenty of people who want to engage with the system and fight it and be very aggressive about it. And I think that there's also people who understand their sovereignty and want to be aligned with that sovereignty. And so I consider them more peaceful warriors. So they're going to be in the more take no shit category, but do that in a very respectful, peaceful way. And in my experience dealing with any law enforcement, so much of the outcome of that has to do with what you're bringing to that circumstance and how you approach it. So if you go in very aggressive, they're going to come back very aggressive. Yeah. But if you treat them with a certain level of dignity and and understanding their sovereignty and understanding their position, that as I we've talked about before, these people just want to go home at the end of the day. They don't, mm-hmm. no one, there's very small percentage of police that go out to go and kill somebody. Sure. There's some that angry people. Yeah, there are some angry people out there for sure that take on that badge because they were teased in school, they were bullied, and they want power. So there is a percentage of people that have that attitude, but I think there's a greater percentage of people that really give a fuck about the world, and mm-hmm. they're just a little maybe misguided about how to engage with the world, and they think becoming a police officer is the or an attorney, that's the way to be a better citizen.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I can't tell you percentages. There are good people that became a police officer because they had good intentions. There is a percentage of sadists. There is a percentage sure. of very low IQ people that are trigger happy after the military. There are people absolutely. That just had no other options. There are people who have mental illness. And just like any profession, I guarantee that all of those things I just said about the cop profession, I'm sorry to say this, but that also exists in the medical world as well. Because absolutely. Of my disability, I have seen physical abuse towards elderly people in nursing homes. And I guarantee that since things began in 2020, the good people left the hospitals. And now the hospitals are experiencing the same level of care that you are seeing behind closed doors in nursing homes. Unfortunately, it breaks my heart. If one of the things I was talking about, if you're talking about with Jason before I moved in with him, was how I really wish that there was something I could do about the eugenics program, that which is the nursing home
sure.
system. And episode, I think maybe it was episode 104, we did an episode like about the life cycle, and I was still like, my name hadn't been said yet on the show, you know, but at the end Crow said something like, and I think there's someone in your life that has some experience with this, and they mentioned nursing homes. So yeah, I'm not really sure which where were we going with that? I'm sorry. That we were talking about the medical world.
Yeah, yeah.
The police officers. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I mentioned that you recently had gone to the hospital, and Brandon, you were a little uptight about it, and Brandon went there with you as your medical advocate.
Okay.
What was that?
All right.
What was that about?
So, I am a paraplegic, but that's the least of my problems. I have like a mystery thing going on. With my, I guess it's probably my esophagus, but I had the people in Louisiana telling me that I had a terrible problem that could possibly kill me and I might need a feeding tube. And they didn't understand what they were looking at during an endoscopy because I have had so much surgery and rearranging of my organs. And they had to get like the oldest doctor in the hospital to come look, and he just shrugged and he's like, I don't know what to say about this. There's all these metal objects and meshes and screws where they shouldn't be, causing bleeding ulcers. We don't know how to remove these items without also removing the intestines. So I put myself, I refused to eat any of the food in the hospital. I certainly wasn't going to drink in shore. And I had brought with me this, like these things that I had just bought from some Owen Benjamin listeners that are also listeners of Crow 777 Radio. His name's Herbalist Bear. And for Christmas, he sent me a $100 gift card to his website. And I just picked some random stuff. And on my way to the hospital, I grabbed those things. And I ended up just drinking those things. And I think it kind of healed me, because by the time I got to California, they were telling me I was perfectly healthy and nothing's wrong with me, but I still have symptoms. But Brandon, I had so much anxiety about everything, about wearing the mask. I refuse to wear the mask. I get very combative. I was diagnosed with ODD a while back, oppositional defiance disorder. I just get so frustrated when I'm around people that I feel do not have the capacity for critical thinking. And it's yeah. my character flaw that I need to work on that. So Brandon actually did. I don't know. I can handle myself better, I think, in certain situations. You could just ask Jason sure. about that. But so Brandon although I had the Louisiana State Legislature in my lap, even though I could cite statutes, even though I understood and could comprehend that all of these people could be held accountable and breaking the law, really, Brandon was just there as a good friend to help me just breathe through the process of the ER and, you know, not freak out during the IV. I have really deep, jagged and I have deep and jagged veins that roll, and over the years, they're just gone. I just don't have veins anymore, just like you would imagine with a heroin addict, you know? Sure. And I don't like needles either. It's just, I just can't stand it. I don't know why I'm so sensitive, but I just was, I don't take being a patient very well. So Brandon really saved the day for me by just sitting next to me, helping me breathe, helping me laugh. And it was amazing. He is an amazing man.
Yeah, we had him on the show, and he was a, my God, not only an encyclopedia of knowledge, but just seemed like a genuinely stand-up dude. Like he was very ethically sound, and he knew where he stood, and he wasn't just about citing statutes and law. I don't even know the terminology for it, but he also was this very spiritual person too. And I think that helped me because I'm very interested in natural law and trying to see how I can, what would be the best way to manifest that in my life where, you know, I don't want to necessarily go to the extreme that Paul Enslaved does by not having a license plate on my car and getting stopped every 2 days and having to have a 45-minute conversation with the cops to explain why I actually don't need a driver's license. So Brandon was good at putting the legal side with the spiritual side. And I think he's a great combo. Yeah, and he just was a really warm person.
Absolutely. So on Thanksgiving, see, it's just Jason and I here. We don't have a lot of family. We don't have any family, not very many people close by, although it's starting to change. But on Thanksgiving, we were working so much and just so distracted. And I haven't been cooking lately because of my health problems. He really wanted a Thanksgiving dinner. And we heard that there was like some kind of Thanksgiving dinner that they were offering at this place called the Saltgrass, some chain, like country food chain, and you know, they offered till 4, and we get there at 3:30, and they didn't have any turkey left for poor Jason.
Aww.
And I just mentioned it to Brandon, and like, he lives an hour away, and the next day we didn't even hear him knock on our door, but he left in our truck, in our van, in the driveway, like a whole entire Thanksgiving dinner. And like gumbo, the whole shebang of cake. And I just couldn't believe it. Like, I woke up and I looked at my text and it was like, hey, I left some really good food in the van in your front. And I hope you guys have a great day. Isn't that
That's
crazy?
Amazing.
I know. It's going to make me cry just thinking about it. I want to tell you about about the whole drive. You know how you just mentioned about the driver's license thing and the motor vehicle code? So I grew up with my dad. Like I said, I was very influenced by my Republican dad. And my dad used to always say, you know, wave at the cops and thank them for their service and thank them for protecting you. And you don't need to be afraid of cops because you don't break the law. Ha ha ha. We'll see how that panned out later in life. But, you know, I wasn't afraid of cops because I wasn't doing anything wrong. Of course, then when I started smoking weed when I was 13, I was a little bit different around cops. But as I got older, I just like kind of was like, I dare you to mess with me for smoking weed. It's California, right? And then California kind of caught up to me with that. But I was never afraid of them and never had any negative feelings. And whenever I would get pulled over for speeding, I would look them in the eye and I would smile and I would say, officer, I know I was speeding and I know that I deserve a ticket. And I know you're probably so sick of hearing excuses from people all the time. I honestly did not think that I would get caught for this and I'm really sorry. And I would get off with a warning, okay? Now, the one time I actually did get a speeding ticket, I was driving home from LA on the 101 at 3 a.m. and I was going like 90 or 88 or 90 miles an hour with no other cars on the road. And I had a lot of marijuana and a pipe and a lighter on my passenger seat. And they just came out of nowhere. They scared me so much, I almost started to pull over to the left. You know what I mean? Like, I was just in shock. I was in shock that I was getting pulled over. I was like, oh, my gosh, and I don't know how I'm going to, like, deal with this situation. And so I pull over, and the cop comes in, and he shines the flashlight on me. He shines the flashlight on my wheelchair, and then he shines the flashlight on the passenger seat with the pipe, the weed, and the lighter, and then back at me. And so I didn't know what to say because I hadn't, you know, I didn't have a plan. Like, I'm sorry, I knew I was breaking the law when I'm smoking weed while driving. I couldn't go with that one, right? So right. they say just wait. You know, and he said, I clocked you at going 88 miles an hour, and I made some weird Back to the Future joke. And then he said, hold on, and another cop car pulls up. So they spent 20 minutes, and I think they were, like, trying to figure out what to do with me. How are they going to arrest me, and how are they going to get me into their car? So instead of, you know, dealing with the marijuana, they gave me, like, a way high, they gave me a speeding ticket for driving over 100 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And I thanked them profusely. Now, today...
and went home and smoked your weed.
Today, I don't carry a driver's license, and I will never carry a driver's license because I am a psycho, like Fallen Slave, where I want to have that interaction. I would love the opportunity to talk to someone about these things and just explain. And I imagine if I got pulled over and they asked me for my identification, I would start off by telling them that I respect them as a human being and that everything I'm about to say has nothing to do with them as an individual, but about a spiritual conviction in my heart. And that the outcome of that conversation could result in me being arrested. But then I'd have cause of action to bring it up to the federal level in the Supreme Court. So I, you know, have I just feel like that's something that I'm willing to do. And for other people, that's insane. Like, why would you want to risk going to jail or having some conversation like that? But to me, it's almost like it would be a test for me to see how able I am to communicate. How can I string words together to get this human being to temporarily separate themselves from their job and just think in a different way? And I think that if I could really make it a genuine experience for my heart, that there's going to be a positive outcome. I just truly believe that. I'm not afraid of that. Now, if I was getting pulled over because I was actually breaking a law, it's not going to work. The only reason why it worked with Paul and Slave is because he was pulled over because he wasn't breaking the law, but he didn't have the license plates. So that's the thing, is you have to be acting in honor. I can't go around running stop signs and red lights and then say I'm right. not required to have it. You have to live right. in honor. You have to walk the walk if you're going to talk yeah. the talk.
Exactly.
Exactly.
But you have a driver's license on your car, right?
A license plate.
It's Jason. Yeah. See, that's the thing, is that it's Jason's car, Jason's license plate, Jason's registration. But I have hand controls in his car. And so if I still had a driver's license, it says that I'm restricted to hand controls, which is funny because it's physically impossible for me to use it the other way. So why is it against the law for me to use my feet if I can't use my feet?
Yeah, so, exactly.
So I'm not sure how that would work out with it not being me. It's not my property. I could say that I'm transferring his property from point A to point B, that I have the right to transfer. I have the right to move from one point to another, and he authorized me to use his property. But what I should really look into is what liability he may have if he was in the car with me at the time. Sure.
And no commerce is involved, so.
Right. Now, but the question is, if he contracted with the DMV and registered the vehicle, does that put him in liability if he allows another living woman to take his property from one place to another? I feel, without looking it up, that I still have the right to move from point A to point B with someone else's property, as long as I have their permission. However, there might be something there about him allowing someone to use his registered property without them being insured. But people let their friends drive their cars all the time without insurance. Yeah, so exactly. I don't think it would be that big of a deal. But I'm so curious about it. I think I'm an excellent driver, so I don't know how I will get pulled over. We'll see.
Yeah, exactly. I've driven illegally so much of my life that I tend to drive like an old lady anyway. So on the outside, I look totally legit.
Yeah. Oh,
and I'm running kilos of coke inside. No,
you're not.
What was I going to say?
For any law enforcement that could be listening.
Yeah, fuck them. They know I'm joking. Have you thought of alternative forms of ID? Like there's the passport for the Conch Republic of Key West, for instance. Have you heard of that?
I haven't heard of that one, but I've heard of so many. There are so many different kinds of identification that you could have. Like, for example, KL. I don't know if you're familiar with KL. The first episode with us was 256, and then we did episode 274 and a bunch more. But he's been using his driver's license, but on his driver's license, I've seen a picture of this, and it's worked forever, in pink bolded capital letters right on the driver's license blocking stuff, it says beneficiary. Like, there are so many different ways that people go about this. Like I said, with the converting to the state national and putting the passports and getting that diplomatic, whatever it's called, I forgot the term. But for me, this is how I roll. I don't want to deal with paperwork ever again. Like, I want to just use the power of my mind and my heart and my words to have a human connection with every human being that I interact with and just see where it goes.
Sure. Yeah.
See where it goes with that. And then, hey, maybe I will be the example to teach everyone that that is not a good idea. But I'm willing to be a trailblazer in that area. I don't ever want to go back to the DMV again.
Yeah. So what does that do for you if you want to travel via airplane? Would you ever do that again?
I have 2 years to decide because my passport expires in 2024.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's a big question. I'm so blessed that I've traveled the world already. I've seen incredible things. Jason has never left the country. I want him to see so many things. I want him to see just even just England, you know, even a place that's still, but then like going to a place where they don't speak English, Greece, Egypt, all of the places that he's researched. I just feel like it's a crime that right at the time when we could, because we doubled our shows in March of 2020 and then Owen Benjamin helped us immensely. Sargent Report helped us immensely. We gained our subscriberships. It's like sadly ironic that now Jason can afford to go on a trip somewhere, but he hasn't been anywhere since 2020 because of all the poppycock. So yes. I hope that he can go on a trip and maybe I will end up renewing my passport in order to travel with him in the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, now is the window actually really to travel, because a lot of countries have lifted the vax mandates that they have for travelers. So yeah. If there was a window to do it, it would probably be within the next year.
And no masks on planes.
No masks on planes.
International, though?
International, too. Yes, and how it works internationally is it's based on the place that you land. Mm-hmm. So if the country like England has no mask mandate right now, so if you go from JFK to Heathrow, you don't have to wear a mask on the plane and you don't have to wear a mask once you arrive there.
Yeah, I was curious about that because, like I said, I went to California and I truly believe it is just being enforced by social shame because.
Yeah.
I never wore a mask from New Orleans, and I landed in LAX with a smile on my face, and no one dared say a word to me because I just was a shining light. I just kept thinking to myself, I am wishing the best for every human being that I am in contact with, and I'm going to ignore the fact that they're wearing a mask. This does not apply to me. You know, this is just, they're living in a different reality. I'm over here in this reality. And I wanted people to observe me in that way because I know that there's got to be a percentage of people who are wearing the mask, even though they didn't want to, because they were afraid of what would happen if they didn't. So, and even with my strong spiritual conviction and my knowledge of everything, it was still so, so difficult to be in that position and to maintain that confidence when I could only imagine what people were thinking around me, you know, and I'm not used to like worrying about other people thinking I'm a bad person in public, you know, it was bizarre. It was definitely a bizarro world when you're in it, just a sea of mask people. Here in Louisiana, I haven't seen a lot of masks in general at all, everywhere. But going on the airplane for the first time was like kind of painful, just to see all these people following along with something that I knew was not correct. And the fact especially that no one ever asked me for anything.
And especially little kids. That's been the heartbreaker for me, is to see an infant wearing a mask.
Absolutely.
But I remember, I lived in New York for 10 years, and I remember a period in New York where you would see people on the train wearing a mask, but it was always an Asian person. And, you know, I lived off of Canal Street, so I lived near Chinatown, and I would ask people, like, why is that person wearing a mask? Oh, they're sick. And I said, well, if they're sick, why are they out in public? And it was explained to me, in China, for example, there are no sick days. If you're sick, you still have to go to work. So the way they handle that is by masking when they go out into public. So when the whole mask thing started, I was like, why are healthy people wearing fucking masks? This doesn't make sense. So this is not about illness. This is about compliance. And I think when I realized that, I because I have complex PTSD, so I can't wear a mask. Even if I wanted to wear a mask, I can't do it.
You're like me.
So I would go into the grocery store and get these vitriolic, like if someone could throw acid on me looks. I had, you know, SJWs coming up to me and literally screaming in my face. And just very calmly turning to them and saying, you don't know me. You don't know my situation. You don't know anything about me. And just leaving it at that, because what I felt like was that it wasn't about health anymore. It was about the virtue signaling of covering your face. And I think a year into it, I got very withdrawn. I gained a bunch of weight. I refused to leave the house. I got really freaked out by the whole situation. And then it got to the point where it was like, I can't be imprisoned by this anymore. I'm going to force myself to go to the store. And when I would look at someone and we would make eye contact, I would smile at them, big red lipstick, you know, full makeup, and I would smile at them, and they would smile at me through the mask. So I could see their eyes squinting, but I couldn't see the smile. And I just thought, wow, this is such a surreal experience to be in, because we are such communal creatures that I'm trying to commune with this person and they're doing it with this shield over their face.
Right.
It was just so sad. And I felt sorry for them, not for myself and not for the getting the negative energy. I felt sorry for people that felt they had the right to infringe on my freedom.
Yeah, I hear ya. And there's also just the whole difference between attitude, that the Chinese, the Asian mask wearing, they're doing it from their perspective, regardless of what you believe about the mask's ability to prevent or cause illness. They're doing it out of respect for the people around them. But when it started here, like you said, it was about conformity and compliance. And it wasn't about, I'm wearing the mask to protect you. It's, hey, you need to wear your mask to protect me. And it wasn't about respect. It was about fear and being afraid of your fellow human, not trying to work it out together in this place.
And control. It was all about controlling other people's behavior. So you would see this guy at Target, for example, the 17-year-old kid that they've put at the door as the greeter, and he's the mask police. this kid who's just barely out of diapers, and he's telling me, a 53-year-old woman, how to conduct myself. I'm like, dude, I have underwear older than you. Like, come on. You're not going to tell me how to comport myself, because I'm not going to sit here and tell you my life history and why I can't wear a mask. It's none of your fucking business.
You don't have to.
It's
anyway.
None of their business. And that's, and see, that's where I feel like I am lucky that I have the wheelchair sometimes, because a lot of people don't question me. And if I tell someone I have PTSD, they're going to probably assume it has something to do with my, my stroke or my wheelchair. And, that's why I wish if I could go back, I wish I had gone out more and put myself out even more at the beginning and been more vocal. It's just that it was so difficult. In March of 2020, I told my family right from the get-go, we've been seeing this coming. This is all this is all contrived and fake. And I was calling it a COVID hoax from the beginning, and I kept trying to ignore all the posts about it before March, before they declared the quote-unquote national emergency. And my sister really, really came back at me with so much aggression. That's how I found out that this was going to be big. You know what I mean? Because I was shocked that she was so angry that I made a post about how I was going to go travel to Hawaii because tickets were cheap. And I didn't even end up going because they right on that day, they like talked about the quarantine. So I would have been stuck at the Hyatt for 14 days, which is like $330 a night. Definitely can't afford that. And I called Hawaii and even my friends were like, yeah, you shouldn't come. It's just not a good time. People are freaking out. I was like, damn, okay. I bet that would. But my sister is like, she's like the opposite of me in a sense that she works for HBO Max. She's a producer and writer of reality television, and the last project that she spent 3 years of her life on is a show called Fuckboy Island. So she's literally writing stories about people trying to screw each other, literally. I shouldn't use that because screw is more of a have sex with each other. And I just can't believe that she, you know, thinks I'm like the most horrible person on earth. You know, and her job is to write reality television, meaning she's writing things that are supposed to be put off as real, you know. And I've always said, you know, I think it is a good idea for us to maybe have a good relationship one day. And I do believe that, you know, there is something more to this world. And I don't really buy into the idea like, oh, sometimes your family just doesn't mesh well. Like, she was just saying, like, I respect your relationship with our parents and you should respect my relationship with our parents, but we shouldn't talk. You know, I sent her a George Carlin clip. You know the George Carlin joke where he's talking about how he didn't die even though he was swimming in sewage during the polio days? So I sent that and I genuinely thought that was funny and that it would, like, you know, have it put a smile. It was the worst decision ever to send her that. And she said, so are you saying that you don't have a compromised immune system? And so I said, absolutely not. I do not have a compromised immune system. And she said, oh, so you go to the hospital for fun? And that triggered me because I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you just said that to me. Because to me, to them, I'm just the crazy person. And so that statement to me is so offensive that even though I wasn't particularly offended by it, I was more triggered by the fact that everyone in my family went to her rescue. And like, they were even giving me bullet points of how I was being too condescending to her. So that's, remember I said that I need to conduct myself better because I have a lot of good things to say and I have really good intentions, but if I come off like a fucking know-it-all, it's not going to work and it's just a waste of everyone's time and pushing us more far apart. So isn't it interesting that I can articulate these things and make sense of these things and give advice to so many people and their families, but I can't seem to figure out this one conflict, this one personal conflict.
Because it's a psyop. It's a psyop.
All right, then. That seems as good a place as any to end the first free hour.
To hear the second hour, just go to patreon.com/themeltpodcast, where for as little as 3 measly bucks per month, you can get access to full episodes, exclusive episodes, and early episodes. So there's all that. In the second hour, we discuss being the change, not paying taxes, Rose's California hospital experience, ancestral healing, and much, much more. All right. I hope that you glean something positive from this. There are ways that you will hear during the closing theme that you can contribute to the melt, but another thing that isn't mentioned is by visiting the merch store, you can contribute financially and also have something tangible to show for it. So there's that. We really appreciate you listening. I hope that you gleaned something positive from this episode. I know that I did, and there are fantastic things coming your way that you don't even know about. All right, until next time, take care, people. If you've liked what you've heard and would like to contribute to the melt, there are a few ways that you can do that. The most tangible would be financially. Just click the Patreon link in the episode notes, and there you will find ways that you can contribute for as little as $3 a month. This will give you access to bonus episodes, early access to regular episodes, and you can also participate in monthly Zoom meetups. Contributing financially will also help make the melt better, pay the bills, and help to make this podcast a full-time endeavor that I can fully devote my time to and provide you with more content. Another way of contributing would be to go to wherever it is that you subscribe to the melt and give it a favorable review or rating, and this will help it to reach more people. You can also spread the word to friends and family via social media, email, or word of mouth. And lastly, if none of those options are readily available or appealing to you, simply send your positive thoughts and intentions. In an interconnected and quantumly entangled multiverse, these also go a long way. Thank you.